The Classical Jazz Quartet playing Rachmaninoff, Concert No. 2, from their 2006 album, fittingly titled, The Classical Jazz Quartet Play Rachmaninoff. That wasn't too hard a stretch to come up with a name, was it? Kenny Barron on piano, Stefan Harris on vibes and marimba, Ron Carter on bass, and Louis Nash on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. And we have a bombshell story for you coming up. I just first wanted to ask a question. Is it something we said yesterday about Donald Trump that made him become a tiny bit contrite and returning to his senses? But we will discuss tomorrow some other details of the storm that hit the Caribbean and, of course, the other storms that hit the United States and the coastlines. But there's a lot going on, and we'll take those things into consideration, but they need space and time. And today, instead, we will use the time to discuss an ongoing story. We have been covering this for a long time, and that is Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, their foundation, the shenanigans associated with the people and their various business enterprises and political enterprises. And we have some interesting developments. Let me first introduce our guest. You know him by voice. He's been here very many times and is considered a leading expert on the whole Clinton kit and caboodle. He has been investigating the Clinton Foundation on his own as a self-initiated project for more than 2 years now. And he has come up with some incredible information that will now take in other major players. And we'll get to that in a moment. Of course, you know, this is Charles Ortel, a financial investigator who has been looking into the business come charity dealings of the Clintons. And he's here to tell us his latest discoveries in what he has consistently been calling the largest unprosecuted fraud in U.S. history. Let me repeat this. This is an ex-president, a former Secretary of State, a former U.S. Senator, who are the principals in a Byzantine operation that in Charles's view, is the largest unprosecuted fraud in U.S. history. Charles Ortel, you might want to be reminded, had taken a look previously. This is around the year 2008-2009, when the stock market was in the process of crashing. But he found that a principal reason was that many Wall Street firms were in fact overvaluing their stock to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. And were it not for his investigation, the crash would have been even more impactful than it turned out to be. Charles, great to have you with us once more.
It's my honor to be back on your show, Yatrice.
I'm so happy because you're doing such great work. I mean, you could have been, and you were, a Wall Street, a big point on Wall Street. You could have stayed there and made some nice money, but you turned your attention to the world of philanthropy, and specifically to charity fraud. That is another way of saying you turned your attention on the Clintons. So tell us, what is the latest, the biggest and latest that we need to find out about the Clintons?
All right. Well, thanks again. I'll try to not weave all over the place. But basically, what I've uncovered in recent weeks, I've been going back over the various WikiLeaks dumps, the one on the Democratic National Committee, the one on Hillary Clinton's emails, and the one on John Podesta's emails. And when you spend time doing that, and, you know, it's a good quiet time with no distractions, what you uncover, what I believe I've uncovered, is the real reason that Lois Lerner stayed as long as she did, Lois Lerner being in charge of the IRS department that regulates all charities from 2006, January, through May of 2000, I believe it was 13 or so. What you uncover is a rich trail of betrayal of the American people. So what was going on, in my view, is that the Clintons figured out, when Bill was still president, when they desperately needed money, that no one really checked carefully enough what was going on with foundations, and that there was a massive interest on the part of Americans in helping out causes that sound good. In fact, the real problem, as Warren Buffett has said in the past, is that, you know, there's too much money looking for good places to help, with good charities to help. And so what you could do when you assert that you're involved in a high-sounding cause, if you're a crook, which I would say the Clintons are, the whole family is crooked, and the people around them are all crooked, is you set up this foundation, you game the system, you're not supposed to operate a foundation, a charity, particularly this is supposedly a publicly supported charity. You're not supposed to operate such an entity for political gain, and you certainly are not supposed to operate it for personal gain. But if you only put inside on the board political cronies, which is exactly what they did, and then if you turn and you hire a tiny little accounting firm or an office of a tiny little accounting firm that in no way was able to really check what was going on with this sprawling global enterprise, what you end up with is a perfect way both to launder money and steal money and divert money for political purposes and personal purposes, which is what I believe they started doing almost from inception on October 23rd, 1997. They never filed.
What led you to believe that? What leads you to believe that is pretty much what they intended to do and that they began to do that far back?
Well, so when you go into the history, at the time, there was obviously a lot of investigations. But since then, not only have there been investigations, but there have been tell-all books by various insiders, including Bill Clinton, including Hillary Clinton, that, you know, tell various strands of the story. There's one by a man called Taylor Branch. I think it's called something like The Secret Tapes or something like that. And that is really instructive because that tells the story of, you know, of what Bill was thinking about in his own words. Of course, you know, Taylor basically is a historian who I think he's a Pulitzer Prize winning historian who wrote a book on the basis of secret tapes that were recorded as early, I want to say, as, you know, very early in the presidency in 93. And he even recounts the genesis of this relationship in the book. Which shows very clearly that, you know, Bill actually, according to the book, wanted to have at government expense an historian record every moment of his presidency. And it says in the book that Bill's lawyers said, no, we can't do that. And that even John Podesta is quoted as having, you know, grave reservations about recording what actually happened during, you know, the presidency. So it's a very interesting tale. And what you learn, I mean, people are quick to talk about Bill Clinton's mandate. In truth, and I'm just speaking, trying to speak clinically. It's going to not necessarily help the Clintons terribly, but just from a clinical perspective, when you get into the facts of the 92 election, Bill Clinton won the election because of Ross Perot. It's that simple. Ross Perot took almost 19-20% of the vote, didn't get a single electoral vote, but he deeply hurt George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton got elected. Not really, I would argue, with a mandate, but he governed as if he had a mandate from day one, firing all 93 U.S. attorneys, which, you know, people forget. And, you know, scandal after scandal leaped up upon him. He used the power of the presidency, which is considerable, and particularly in a pre-internet age. You know, the president is the most covered person on the planet, at least at this moment and back then. And so you cut off access to the President of the United States, you don't have much of a media business left. So he was very skillful at doing that, very skillful at stiff-arming investigations. There have been allegations. I don't think they've been investigated deeply enough that the Chinese government intervened heavily in the 1996 election. And by 1997, you know, the worst of all possible worlds happened to Bill and Hillary Clinton. The cost of defending themselves skyrocketed. And it was revealed that this restaurant dude, Charlie Tree, who I think there have been some recent developments involving his benefactor. But anyway, Charlie Tree, a foreign national, was discovered funneling money into the First Legal Expense Trust. So that didn't work because that's illegal. And they had to wind the first one down. They created a second one. And also, you know, the various, I would argue, spurious legal defenses that were mounted were cast aside. And the case that Paula Jones was trying to, prosecute against the Clintons was allowed to go forward. At least discovery for that case was allowed to go forward. So they had gigantic legal bills. I don't know how many millions at that point in time. They had no way of raising money through the First Legal Expense Trust, so they created the Second Legal Expense Trust. They also had a slush fund, I would argue, in the second presidential inaugural fund, which I've tried to get the papers on that one, and I've been denied. I've filed a Freedom of Information Act request. I've been denied. Who knows how much money they took in for that thing, what they used the money for. We're told in the book by Joe Connison, that, and it's confirmed in the release by the Clinton Foundation itself, that between $1 and $5 million went from the second presidential inaugural into the Clinton Foundation. And the first filing that is made for the Clinton Foundation concerns 1998, and there is a sum of $2.3 million, which would be between $1 and $5 million, that is the largest single donation in 1998. But there are no tax filings for 1997, and the rules are strict that when you organize a foundation, you absolutely have to file a tax return for the date of organization through the end of the first year, the so-called short period. There is no short period of filing for 1997. So, well, you know, we don't really know, A, what happened, who had custody and control over the second inaugural fund bank accounts. We do know that Terry McAuliffe and I believe Vernon Jordan's wife, Ann Jordan, were both involved with that second inaugural committee and both served, in Terry McAuliffe's case, for many, many years as directors of the Clinton Foundation. So those connections are not appropriately teased out, nor are the connections that David Pryor, who was appointed to head, former senator and I think governor of Arkansas, who was appointed to head up the second presidential second presidential legal defense trust. You know, those ties are not appropriately explained in Clinton Foundation filings, because he not only served as a trustee of the Clinton Foundation, he also served, I think, as the first dean of the Clinton School of, in quotes, public service at the University of Arkansas, which is, you know, in a building on the Little Rock, Arkansas campus of the Presidential Center. None of these ties, which should have been teased out and explained in full, are explained in full in the Clinton Foundation tax filing. Why is this significant? Because David Pryor admits in the public statements and elsewhere that the Presidential Expense Trust raised a lot of money from individual donors. Well, how did they solicit that money? Did they solicit it through the Clinton Foundation? And if they raised tons of money for the expense trust in 98, who I think the figure is something tens of thousands of contributions, why is it that for 1998 there are only three contributions listed for the Clinton Foundation itself in 1998? So, you know, what I think the Clintons figured out with that exercise when he was still president, and what they assumed through the 2000 election, was that they would have control over the Department of Justice, they would have control over the IRS, and they could continue to milk this foundation for as long as possible as a rogue enterprise. As a rogue enterprise that would never have trustees who would follow the law, would never use accounts who would really check where all the money is. And if you start having, you know, as they have declared, over $2 billion of money go your way, but the IRS isn't really checking and your trustees don't care, it becomes a perfect way to, you know, get governments and leaders of governments to have their government send money to the Clinton Foundation, then have the Clinton Foundation turn around and route the money back to former leaders and foundations of former leaders. It becomes a perfect money-washing exercise, all in the guise of charity. And people, as they say, you know, if you want to, I think the saying about bankruptcy and banks, you know, if you want to get in serious trouble with a bank, you know, borrow a small amount of money and they'll put you right in bankruptcy. But if you want to get away with murder, borrow as much money as possible, and then you would effectively own the bank, because they can't put you into bankruptcy without trouble for themselves. That's, I think,
speaking
what happened
of which,
here.
I just want to ask a question. It's one thing to say that they're getting the money. They have a plan. The plan is coming together. They have people strategically placed in the IRS and in other areas that would afford them a very nice cover, because, we even had James Comey serving that role. So apart from the fact that they were beginning to rake in the dollars and they were beginning to perfect their formula, how did they bank this money?
Well, so there's always a crooked bank officer out there somewhere. There's so many bank branches. One bank that has fallen under immense scrutiny is, not enough scrutiny, frankly, is HSBC, Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation. I think, speaking of James Comey, I think when he was in private life, he was appointed a director, I believe, of that thing, which, you know, has had problems, particularly in the Swiss branch, the Geneva, Switzerland branch of the Hong Kong HSBC. Banks need deposits, and particularly in Europe, where individual countries are small, much smaller than the United States, and where they nonetheless have these gigantic banks, they don't have what are called, checkable deposits. As many, ordinary human beings, you need a checking account, you got to have it somewhere. That's free money for a bank. They don't have to, generally, they don't pay interest on that deposit, and they're always hungry for deposits. And European banks in particular are at a strategic disadvantage to U.S. banks. So you pretty much, fraudsters understand that you can always find a place to park these deposits. They're hungry for them. And as a guess, that's exactly what the Clinton Foundation did. If you turn off the governor, you turn off the switch that's supposed to regulate a foundation or a charity, you could run hog wild with it. I mean, you could do the following. This is what I suspect they've been doing. You go to a high-tax jurisdiction like New York City. You allow your cronies to say they gave money to your foundation. And let's say they give you appreciated illiquid private stock, in theory. You can then write off, a large amount against your high personal income tax rate. And if you operate a crooked charity, you then set up an illegal bank account in a place like the Cayman Islands, and you say, or some place like that, and you say to your friend, because we like you, you can get this tax benefit if you've given us real money, but go down to the Cayman Islands and you just get your money back. And if you don't check this kind of stuff, it's just open season. And I think what's happened, the reason I start back in 97, I think prosecutors like to establish a pattern and practice. And this is a repetitive pattern in practice. It seems like the monkey business that I see generally escalates in each presidential election cycle. So that the first case I see of massive fraud, that is to say, of stuff where you can detect errors in the books, the perfect thing about, in quotes, perfect thing, because nothing is actually perfect, but the great thing about accounting for we nerds is that accounting books have to balance. And if they do not balance, and if there's three important statements for any enterprise, what's called an income statement that measures how much you earned and how much you spent, then a balance sheet, which measures at a point in time, what is your net worth? What are your total assets? What are your liabilities? What's your net worth? Then there's a third statement called a cash flow statement, which absolutely has to be prepared as a matter of regulation of the laws for foundations beginning in 1993. The Clinton Foundation omitted, did not, somebody at the Clinton Foundation made a decision, A, to use accounting that is not allowed in the United States of America, specifically states that in their books, and B, to omit this crucial cash flow statement. So when somebody like me sees that, you say right away there's a problem. There is no good reason to omit a cash flow statement and be simultaneously prosecuting a construction contract, a large construction contract in a state like Arkansas, which is rife with corruption. Construction projects are, as we know from the Big Dig in Boston and big projects around the world, construction projects are excellent ways to launder money. Who really checks how many yards of cement went into a project? How many board feet of lumber? How many, actual length of electrical lifts and how many air conditioning? Nobody generally checks it carefully enough. So if you want to make money disappear, you can make it disappear into a construction project. You can say, that the construction project, as they did say, cost $165 million, where there is no evidence in their books that they actually spent $165 million. But if you say you spent that money, you can make money disappear. And so people like me, and it's not like it's rocket science, it's far from it, science. If you give me an income statement, you give me a balance sheet, I can construct the cash flow statement. And I can then, by looking at the constructed cash flow statement and looking at what they said, I can find places where you lied about how much debt you actually raised in a year, thereby disguising the theft of $28 million, where I could figure out that, you said that an expense was a cash expense, but it wasn't. It was a non-cash expense. So $36 million disappeared plus $64.5 million, I would argue, was stolen from the Clinton Foundation in 2004. What happened in 2004? The Democratic Party needed to win an election, and they lost. Who was the chairman of the Democratic Party in 2004? Terry McAuliffe. Was he a director of the Clinton Foundation? Yes, he was. Yes, we can. He was a director of the Clinton Foundation from, I believe, 99 or 2000, right the way to November 2013 when he became governor of Virginia. So you can see that in 2004. Then in 2007-8, they had amped up this illegal HIV-AIDS thing, and in my view, and now the big money started disappearing. Now hundreds of millions started disappearing in that cycle. And so the bombshell that I believe I've uncovered now, I think I understand why Barack Obama and Eric Holder, let's not forget that he was in the Clinton White House. He was a deputy attorney general, I believe, under, I think it was Janet Reno. And he was the one centrally involved in the Mark Rich pardon, although he claims, you know, he tried to claim that he wasn't really all that knowledgeable about what was going on there. You had Eric Holder. You had many, many Clinton appointees in the Obama White House. And, you know, when you look, as we've discussed in prior interviews, when you look at the Memorandum of Understanding dated December 12, 2008, it could not be farther from the truth. It is just a pack of lies and knowing lies, because just at that moment in time, the Clinton Foundation was very late, woefully late, way past the final filing deadline in New York and California, and they were sending and have sent, and they're on the public record, false declarations to the state of New York, to the state of California, about why the audits weren't finished. He said, you know, our auditors haven't completed our work. There's a letter you'll find in California, a letter you'll find in New York and in other states, from this crooked firm called the Nonprofit Service Corporation, something like that, where they just are lying through their teeth, because the very date of the letter where they say their auditors have not completed the work is right around, right past the time that the auditors had completed their work on December 12, 2008. It was a bold-faced lie. And, you know, by the time Barack Obama, well, at the time, I imagine, I'm only guessing, you know, you watch what happens when a new president wins and has to put together a team. You know, it's a massive exercise. You got to, in theory, vet all the people. There are a lot of positions to fill. A lot of people want favors. A lot of jockeying going on. So, you know, I can imagine that in the whirlwind that followed the historic victory of Barack Obama over John McCain, or as I like to call him, John McLean, you know, Valerie Jarrett and others were very preoccupied and certainly could not have known as much about the Clinton Foundation as the Clintons did. And the Clinton Foundation, all you know, the Wikipedia, WikiLeaks stuff shows it clearly in Podesta emails. The public filings show it clearly that were not available at the time they were putting this thing together. The Clinton Foundation was basically defunct. They had their principal operation, their HIV-AIDS operation, had its authority to operate in Massachusetts, involuntarily revoked on March 31st, 2008, with effect from December 31st, 2007. Nonetheless, they were raising hundreds of millions of dollars for that entity, and they even convinced their largest donor, Unité, the Swiss-based organization, to advance them hundreds of millions of dollars ahead of when they were really due the money. So this operation, this illegal operation, had been shut down by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts March 31st, 2008, yet, on December 12, 2008, they represent the Team Obama, everything's hunky-dory with all aspects of the foundation. They also craft an agreement, which lawyers will confirm, is not an enforceable agreement. A memorandum of understanding sounds wonderful. You know, politicians love to sign them. Governments love to sign them. But memorandums of understanding, or if you want to be formal, memoranda of understanding, are completely meaningless documents by design. They are not enforceable. So why did Barack Obama and why did the Clinton Foundation enter into a meaningless agreement to regulate a charity that was basically defunct and should have been put down at that moment in time?
Could I advance an idea as a response to that question? And tell me whether I'm on track. Because it is possible that by that time, among the things that the Clintons did and that Obama benefited from was tutelage. He had an opportunity to understand how this moneymaker could really work.
Exactly.
The Clintons generating literally billions of dollars, a lot of it disappearing. It looks legal. They have interviews touting the good works that they're doing. Everything is going great. And they carefully have put together a new kind of crime that's almost, you have everything free, you're scot-free. And it could be the case that because they had so many shared interests at that time, and Obama coming out of the Democratic Party, close to the Clintons, that this was an opportunity to study this kind of enterprise, which makes tons and tons of money, and nobody's the wiser. And therefore, he decided to really refine this endeavor, because inevitably, when he leaves office, and maybe even before that, he can set the clock in motion, so that by the time he retires from office, he has a plan, and he would be following it as he is now.
You're stealing my thunder.
Oh, really? Is that it?
Yeah. No, I'm just teasing. So if we go back into the history, the official timeline, according to Hillary Clinton herself, in the book, not the latest book, What Happened, but the book, Hard Choices, which I would perhaps retitle Painful Choices. But, in that book, she claims that they were walking in the woods. They seemed to love the woods. And Bill gets a call on his cell phone, and it's Barack Obama, and the reception isn't good. And this is in November 2008, and that's when the talks began, according to her, who would imagine that she might be lying in her own book. But that's when the discussions about being Secretary of State started. I don't believe that. I think what really happened is that Hillary and the Clintons were prepared to fight Obama. The noise it's making that she might mount a floor fight at the convention, but she stopped. They stopped that. You go back into the history, the head of the Democratic Party in Arkansas was murdered in August of 2008. In September of 2008, a woman named Kumiki Gibson, that's K-U-M-I-K-I, there's a memo that she began preparing, that first draft of which is in the Podesta email, that was delivered to Bruce Lindsay right after the election in 2008. It required a lot of work. It describes a foundation that is boldly illegal. I mean, in her own words, this is a lawyer, mind you, asked by Bruce Lindsay to study the Clinton Foundation, the true state of the Clinton Foundation. It discusses the Clinton Foundation had that Ira Magaziner and another executive at this HIV/AIDS thing had diverted, which is a polite way of saying stolen money, and that they covered that up by raiding a, quote, quasi-endowment, a term that has no meaning. There's no such thing as a quasi-endowment. There's either an endowment or there is an endowment. And you can't borrow money from an endowment for some other purpose. You read this memo. It's on there for you. People who are listening, you can read it for yourselves, and especially lawyers. Take a look at this memo. So she didn't just do this by herself. Bruce Lindsay, the consigliere for the Clinton family and president of the Clinton Foundation for a long period of time, orders that this memo be produced. He is himself a lawyer. The memo comes to him and it tells him your foundation is, in horrible shape. This memo cannot have been shown to BKD, the accounting firm, because if BKD had seen that memo, they would never have been able to issue an audit. It says, you're out of kilter in all your domestic filing, your state filings. You have possible diversion of endowed monies, which is a serious crime. Your fundraising, your main operation, you know, it doesn't have authority to operate. This is not in the memo, but the main operation that has an overwhelming majority of the revenues is not allowed to function. And so I suspect that a deal was made with between the Clintons and the Obamas well before November that, you know, Hillary would be inserted into the Secretary of State position. She would have control of, you know, primary control of all interactions with foreign governments. They needed to game the Senate to get her confirmed. So they covered up what was really going on in key states like New York and California with the foundation, which normally have very serious filings. They stopped those filings from going through prior to the confirmation hearing, which I think was on January 13th, 2009. They put her in place, and, you know, Obama and his team could not possibly have known how bad the situation was at that moment in time. Now, we also know from the Secretary's, I think it's the Secretary of State emails, and maybe it's also the Podesta emails, that early on in, you know, after the election, the Obama team was requesting security briefings on a whole bunch of countries that were ultimately later destabilized through the Arab Spring. So the plan for destabilizing the Middle East, you know, I would argue, began prior to Obama's inauguration, and they needed a way to monitor this that was off the books. And I believe one way of doing that would have been to use the Clinton Foundation as cover. And we learn, when you go carefully through the Clinton Foundation emails, what you discover is that in March, specifically after March 16th, 2017, so a day before St. Patrick's Day, 2011, the Clinton Foundation opened a secret office at 77 Water Street as either a tenant or subtenant of Goldman Sachs. And there are emails back and forth. I'm doing this show now on YouTube with Jason Goodman called Sunday with Charles. And the most recent edition of it allows you, if you go on, there are links to these emails. And you know, it's about an hour-long show where I explain some of this. You can see for yourselves. Go on the Podesta emails WikiLeaks dump and Google 77, I mean, insert 77 Water Street as a search term, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Beginning November, I think it was 3rd, 2011, well before the 2012 election, various and sundry people, Chelsea included, using her fictitious alias email, dreynolds@clintonemail.com, is asked by an operative, Laura Graham, with copies to John Podesta, you know, what does your mother need in the way of space at 77 Water Street? Well, why would the Secretary of State need space at 77 Water Street? And there are other incriminating emails that talk about, you know, we better not let the public know about this. It wouldn't look very good. You follow all these strands.
I have to interrupt you here because I don't want people to miss what you've just said, and I want to be sure that I understood what you have just said. Was this by the secret arrangement by Hillary Clinton? Was she actually plotting, and I use the polite word here, in secret, regime change as her own kind of government? And was she doing this? How would this have furthered her political ambitions?
Well, I actually think it was a marriage of interests. I think the team behind Barack Obama was very interested in seeing the Muslim Brotherhood flourish across the Middle East. And, you know, these Middle East potentates have a lot of money and a lot to lose. So it became a marriage of convenience in my mind, is my view. And I believe that, you know, one of the reasons that the Clinton Foundation was never appropriately disciplined, and one of the reasons that the Lerner investigation is going nowhere, and the email investigation is going nowhere, is that Hillary Clinton is not the only person who had secret emails. Barack Obama likely had secret emails. Valerie Jarrett had secret emails. This type of a gigantic enterprise where you're shaking down foreign governments for contributions and then, you know, sending them around the world is a very complex thing. You need to memorialize it. You need to remember who bribed you and who you bribed. And so there are a lot of records. And, you know, I believe that what happened was, is, you know, when Team Obama came under the tent, as you pointed out, may have come under the tent, rather than shut this thing down, which is what they should have done, they said, this sounds like one heck of a party. I'm in. You know, you'll be Secretary of State for one term. That'll give you plenty of time to then run for president. You know, I've got your back. And then when I'm out of office, you know, you're going to look the other way as I carry on for the ensuing 8 years. I think that was the basic element of the bargain. And what makes me feel ever more confident about that is, you know, the more and more I study at the Barack Obama Foundation, the sloppier and sloppier it seems to me to be. So, you know, I think
that he has already begun fundraising for the Barack H. Obama Foundation, which is not even close to being built, but he's soliciting. And basically, it appears that the model he's following is the same model that the Clintons followed. And I also want to ask you about 77 Water Street. Do you think, now she's a government official, and her husband was president and so forth, you think that people would be very careful? But this was not an address that seemed to be well known. It seemed to be a secret address, because I have never heard, there's never been a public mention of her offices being at 77 Water Street.
Well, you know, you used to live in New York for a long time. I'm sure you remember the days when you would walk around New York and you couldn't go a couple blocks without seeing yet another homeless person sitting at a card table with a gigantic glass bottle filled with change, where you were asked to contribute a penny to the homeless. Okay? That was a complete fraud, that case, that there was no such foundation. And basically what these crooked people were doing is renting out space to homeless people to sit in front of a jar, and then they'd split the proceeds of the jar every day. That's in essence what this Clinton Foundation is. The Clintons were homeless, and you know, they set this thing up, and no one's ever, you know, really checked. It's never been audited, and they've been having the cover, you know, in key states like New York and California, where there are many donors, many rich donors, and a strong temptation, you know, to monkey with crooked charities, multiple temptations. You know, you have Andrew Cuomo now in New York as our governor. You have Eric Schneiderman, who's a partisan hack in California. You've got Jerry Brown, who I would argue is, you know, actually living in the moon somewhere, the one or another planet. And you've got Xavier Becerra as the attorney general, who it turns out was the person who hired the L1 team, you know, Debbie Wasserman Schultz scandal that's still not fully explored. So you have, you know, the Clintons knew and the Obamas knew that, you know, the key state forms that would catch this stuff ordinarily would never be regulated because they had partisans in those places. And what I'm referring to, Utrecht, is the standard trick that New York law is actually, as written on the books, very clever, but as enforced, ridiculous. So people understand, who've been around charities, that one of the oldest games in the world is to assert that you are connected to a charity and direct people to send donations to an address. The only problem is that address has nothing to do with the charity. As I learned, I think I'll relate this tale again. Early on, I want to say it was December of 2015 or thereabouts, it was right around then. I'd scan every day the Clinton Foundation on Google, and I was doing that, and up popped an announcement saying, you know, please enter this raffle, where the first prize will be a chance to run on the beach with Bill Clinton on New Year's Day during his vacation. And I looked at that and I said, that's interesting. I wonder where he's going to go on vacation. And it said, the William J. Clinton Foundation of Gambia. Now, my ex-brother-in-law and his wife spent a very pleasant week in Gambia one year or many years back. So I happen to know, actually, that Gambia is a small country in Africa known for its nuts. I mean, its peanuts and things like that. But so I happen to know that it would be credible that Bill might have spent vacation, you know, in Gambia. Then I checked. A, there was no Clinton Foundation in Gambia, and B, Bill Clinton was certainly not in Gambia during it. So this was just a transparent attempt to steal money from gullible people in Gambia. And that, in essence, is what New York was wise to, and why in New York you were required to list out every single office in New York State where, if you register, where your foundation operates. And if you read it strictly, I would read it to say you actually have to list out every single office that you have around the world if you want to raise money here in New York. This is to check precisely this type of stuff. So you absolutely cannot, you know, have... What were they doing? They had secret servers, we know, in Chappaqua and Washington, D.C., and who knows where else. They had secret emails, alias accounts, secret offices, and Hillary, you know, today is trying to make, and I don't really have a lot of time for Jared Kushner, but she's trying to make, as she always does, false equivalence between Jared Kushner having, you know, sent 100 responses on his personal, less than 100 responses in theory on his personal email account to the Clinton machine's practice of somehow negotiating with somebody and getting the right to send 100% of their official government correspondence over a private, unregulated set of servers, and then to keep that information until, I guess, March of 2015 or thereabouts, and now only maybe give back some of it. Right? There's no equivalence there. So you cannot do you can't hide these emails, and you cannot operate a charity in New York State from a secret office. You're not allowed to do that. And I did triple check if they did not disclose in the publicly available forms an address in 2011 at 77 Water Street, nor in subsequent years. And you're supposed, in certain states, ask you to, you know, explain that even if it's not in their home state, you've got to explain these various offices. So when you have secret offices, secret servers, as a guest, they have secret bank accounts that have not been declared. I know, for example, on their U.S. tax forms, you're supposed to list out in the form the identity of any country where you maintain a bank account. And though the Clinton Foundation has controlled a joint venture involving Frank Schuster up in Canada and therefore must have bank accounts in Canada, they have not listed out on their tax forms yet that they had bank accounts in Canada. So if you're going to leave one off in Canada, chances are you're going to leave one off in a place like, say, the Bahamas, where they operated for many number of years. And who knows what other tax haven jurisdictions they may have secret bank accounts involving foundations that have similar sounding names but are not exactly the same as the Clinton Foundation. That's one of the oldest tricks in the book.
How many people would you say were extremely and strategically important in maintaining this shadow entity? And how is it that they've all escaped, or they seem to have escaped, any kind of scrutiny?
Well, I think what fraudsters like to do is they like to involve you in the fraud so that, you know, now 20 years into this, it becomes very difficult to admit that you allowed a fraud to escalate over 20 years and to fool, you know, 50 states, Washington, D.C., multiple foreign countries, multiple sophisticated donors, people like Bill Gates, the shrewd hedge fund guy, Christopher Hone, who runs Children's Investment Fund Foundation and the Children's Investment Fund in the UK and elsewhere. I mean, there are a whole bunch of very smart people who should have seen this. There are a whole bunch of governments. I mean, the government of the UK and of France and various foreign countries, Norway, Australia, New Zealand, city governments around the world, There are all sorts of people. Mike Bloomberg is a pretty smart guy, very smart guy, very successful guy, very experienced in philanthropy. You know, you don't want to admit that you're either duped, you didn't see it, which means you're not as smart as you think, or you decided to look the other way because you figured you'd get something out of it. You'd have, you know, an ability to maybe suggest to the Hillary Clinton administration, had that materialized, that, you know, you really don't want to go after me for antitrust, or you really don't want to prosecute my friend too aggressively here. Or you might have the ability, you know, over time, when you look, I've mentioned this before, in the national income and product accounts data put out by the Bureau of Economic Analysis of the Commerce Department, when you look at the amount of the value of goods and services purchased by our federal and state and local governments each year, there's an enormous opportunity to, you know, make money, in particular off no-bid contracts with our governments. So you contribute a small amount to the foundation, and you get a big contract back. And I think this practice involves the uniparty. This is not simply a Democratic disease. It is a Republican disease. It is a crony disease. And after all, I mean, when you look at the income data in the United States of America, you know, people love to, you know, talk about millionaires and billionaires, but the richest quotient in this country, the richest segment in this country, people who are in the top 20% of all households, their average income for a whole year is less than $200,000, and about slightly more than two people are working in each of those households. So the income is more like $100,000 per person in the richest of all households on average. Yeah, that includes the basketball stars and the football stars and the hedge fund people and all that. So giving $100,000 of after-tax money to a PAC, or $500,000, you know, it's a very small group of people who could really do that. And why would you do that? I mean, why do you really need to do that? I mean, the only reason to do that is because, you know, you're really stupid, or you expect to get something back for the donation. Now, Terry McAuliffe, in his book, I think it's called, like, Quite a Party or something like that, which is probably not the smartest thing to admit in a book when you might run for president one day, talks about the fact of how much money he made, you know, by exploiting contacts derived through his political activities. You know, so there is a market in influence. And, you know, there's a reason when people start, you know, paying Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton $400,000 for a speech, Bill Clinton, there's a reason for that. You don't do it because you just, you know, want to help out Barack. He only has three mansions. I mean, you know, he's got to get another one together. I mean, you're doing it because you think you're going to get something back. And our press, our mainstream press, is captured. It's under assault from Google and Facebook in terms of advertising revenues and Craigslist in terms of the classifieds. You know, it's outmoded. It's wedded to a last millennium structure where the news is too late and too filtered. And it's just very easy to capture, and it is captured. So the people who are doing the investigating are people like you, Utrecht, your guests, people on podcasts, you know, some very few in the mainstream press. Some actually over at One America News Network and Fox, even the people, believe it or not, at RT and Sputnik, some foreign journalists. But, you know, we're not digging deeply enough into this uniparty mess, and we're not getting together and saying, you know, this politics of division, it's a distraction. The people who are pulling the levers at the top and making the politicians dance to their tune want an artificial divide between the left and the right. They don't want people in the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, independents, figuring out that we actually have common interests. We have common interests in bringing the deep state under real control. We have common interests in making sure that before this country goes to war again, we think it through carefully and learn from our mistakes. We have common interests in you know, busting the monopoly over education that is conspiring to keep even our best and brightest students in the dark.
Well, Charles, we have to leave it there for today because we've run out of time this time.
All right.
But it means that we have to have another date to finish off what we've started here today. I want to thank you for your tenacity and for taking this on as a citizen. This is incredible citizen journalism work in which you are hunting down these pariahs who are ripping the people of this country off big time and getting away with it. And it is, in fact, a great privilege to have you in our midst, bringing us the real story behind what this is not being covered, but you bringing us the real story. And I thank you so much for being with us today. We'll talk again soon, and so you can finish up this chapter of this ugly story. Coming up next, Ring of Fire Radio. Stay tuned for that. It's a great program. And Charles, again, I'm sorry I cut you off there, but we'll talk soon. All right. Stay tuned, as I said, for Ring of Fire Radio. It's a new program, and it's a substantive program, and you'll get a lot out of it. And we'll see each other tomorrow. Thanks for listening, and please pass the word about PRN.FM and about this humble little program. Okay? Thank you so much. Bye-bye.